Okay, good morning. Welcome to this session on the Guatemala STD clinical studies. My name is Jonathan Zentelman. I'm a professor, I'm a professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, and I'm the moderator of this session. In the context of this presentation, my role is I was a technical consultant to the Presidential Commission, and that's my role in this series of studies. We have five presenters this morning, which are going to review the issues that were raised by the Guatemala studies, which came to light in October of 2010. There's a change in the program in that the first presenter will be Valerie Bonham, who was until last week was the director. It was the director of the Presidential Commission on Bioethical Issues. That will be followed by myself. Then the next speaker will be Paul Lombardo, who is also a member of the commission as a professor of law at Georgia State University, followed by Dr. Dan Solmazy, who's an internist and bioethicist at the University of Chicago and also a member of the commission, who will explore the bioethical issues. The last speaker is Dr. Brad Stoner, who is the vice president of the American STD Association and who will formulate review the ASTDA's response to some of the very troubling questions that are raised in this investigation. And then we hope to have plenty of time for questions. We anticipated that there would be a fair number of questions. And we would prefer to have the questions at the end because there is a storyline which we're going to be trying to follow. So I'd like to first introduce Valerie Bonham to come. Valerie's a lawyer by training and bioethicist who for the past year and a half has been the chairperson of the Presidential Commission, and we'll go over the initial part of the Guatemala studies.
Thank you. I'd like to thank John for making me the chair of the commission. Thank you for having us. Thank you very, very much for your interest in the work that we've done. My job is to set up for you the work that we did, and then the rest of the panelists will talk with you about some of the more specifics. First of all, I want to tell you who the Bioethics Commission is. The Bioethics Commission is a national, independent advisory committee to the President of the United States and the United States government. We were created by President Obama. We've functionally been in business about 20 months. And here's a picture. The chair is the president of University of Pennsylvania. The vice chair is the president of Emory. The membership includes the head of a Parkinson's Foundation, practicing physicians and ethicists, several law professors, geneticists, folks that come from a diverse background across this country. They meet quarterly in public meetings, and they give advice. That's what they do. The timeline with regard to the Guatemala investigation, now I've told you who the commission is, and they existed, they were created in the fall of 09, functionally the summer of 10. They were existing and standing when the Guatemala events were first announced. The president turned to them subsequently as a standing body to advise him. Now, the timeline of the Guatemala events. In the June of 2003, a historian at Wellesley College goes into the University of Pittsburgh archives, and she finds a detailed set of records from Dr. John Cutler concerning research in Guatemala. She was doing research on Tuskegee, and she finished that work. She published that work. She went back to the Guatemala records. She prepared a paper on them. She contacted the former head of CDC, David Sensor, who many of you may know, who then contacted other folks within the government. The government spent the summer of 2010, CDC and others, looking at these records, and they decided there was a serious concern here. And the announcement of the facts was made in October 2010, at which point the President of the United States called the President of Guatemala and apologized on behalf of the American people to the people of Guatemala for these egregious events. The Secretaries of Health and Human Services also issued apologies, and they called for an independent investigation. As you can see from the quick headlines, the story did break rather widely around the world. In November, this is just to show you how this works. In November, the president sent a letter to Dr. Gutman, the chair of the Bioethics Commission, and he asked her to do two things. The first was oversee a thorough fact-finding, an independent investigation into the events in Guatemala. And the second was to do a contemporary assessment of human subjects protection standards today around the globe for any research that the United States funds. So as I said, the commission had two charges beginning in January 2010 with a rather fast turnaround time of approximately 9 months. So this is the report that we did on Guatemala. I brought it with me, and I would be more than happy. In fact, I would be privileged to send each and every one of you copies of it, because as an advisory committee, all we do is give advice and provide information, and part of that public discourse and sharing of information is what we exist for. So the upshot of the investigation, at the end of the day, I and the staff, with the input from the commission, reviewed over 125,000 pages of documents, which we called from archives across this country. We reviewed, we consulted with Dr. Zendelman as our independent cephalologist, and we prepared a database of everything that could be known about any individual involved in this research from a wide variety of records, some examples of which I'm going to show you. At the end of the day, it was over a million lines in this big, giant database, page of which I'm going to show you, and it's online. So from the records found in the University of Pittsburgh, there was correspondence, notebooks, think of the work that you do. And it's a huge variety of information, note cards of individual subjects, photographs, assorted miscellaneous letters and correspondence, clippings from the newspaper, just a huge variety of information about this research in Guatemala. As an aside, this represents the entirety of the records that Dr. Cutler provided to the University of Pittsburgh for his archives. And he did it 10 years before he died. They were in the archives for some time. So now I'm going to just outline for you what these experiments were all about. There were serology studies. The experiments began in Guatemala in the summer, fall of 46. They were initiated, went to a study section. I'll walk you through that in a moment, in winter of 45, and went down to Guatemala in the spring of 46. And the researchers started with serology because they had trouble diagnosing syphilis. The original study design here was, let's use commercial sex workers, commercial sex work was legal in Guatemala at the time, I believe it still is, as vectors for syphilis. Syphilis was a major public health threat at the time. And then develop a prophylaxis. We're using prisoners, a controlled population. So that was the basic study design. This is the summary. Between 46 and 53, serology studies were done with orphans, school children, leprosarian patients, servicemen, and all the populations involved in the intentional exposure, which only ran 46 to 48. Methods, blood draws, lumbar punctures, cisternal punctures. The picture I show you there is Dr. Cutler with one of the patients in the asylum. The researchers had difficulty identifying and consistently identifying the subjects, and they took pictures of them. The intentional exposure experiments, at the end of the day, involved commercial sex workers, prisoners, psychiatric patients, and soldiers. The diseases to which people were intentionally exposed, not necessarily infected, but intentionally exposed, with the goal of infecting, but nevertheless, everybody was infected. Gonorrhea, syphilis, and chancroid. The methods, sexual intercourse, that was the original plan. And as Dr. Zendelman will explain to you in greater detail, over time and somewhat contemporaneously, the methods were more invasive, for lack of a better word. Direct injection, scarification, abrasion, cisternal punctures. I think it's important to understand how this came to be, and part of what the Bioethics Commission uncovered and tells in the book, which we try to tell as much as a story as anything else, is the institutional support for this research. This was not, as is often anticipated, I think it's fair to say this is my personal use of an adjective, a rogue investigator off on their own without any knowledge by his superiors. Again, I emphasize that's my personal translation. At the end of the day, the Public Health Service Venereal Disease Division supported this research. They were in Staten Island at the time, and the dollars, roughly $180,000, which remember this is $46, is a pretty big award, relatively speaking. Came from those funds. NIH at the time, for those of you who are students of history, NIH was the Public Health Service Act of 1944 created the authorities that we have today for NIH's great big grant program. And the model that we use today of a study section and an advisory council and then approval from the NIH director is the same model that was employed back in 46. And NIH, I'll get to this, the very first study section convened under their new authorities was the syphilis study section. And among the 8 or 10 projects that they reviewed in that very first meeting was this proposal. And anticipating a question, no, we never found an actual protocol. I'm not sure there was one, but that's beside the point. So NIH issued a grant to the Pan American Sanitary Bureau, now the Pan American Health Organization. PASB, great big non-governmental organization. PASB built laboratory in Guatemala with this money, negotiated agreements with the government of Guatemala. This is not a case either of the United States going into a country without engagement or involvement of foreign leaders. They were involved. They built laboratory, they negotiated agreements. The government of Guatemala supplied staff. The VDRL supplied staff, paid for individuals to go down and do this work. I mentioned the fact that the syphilis study section approved this. The National Advisory Health Council approved it. The Surgeon General approved it. Again, this isn't a case, as far as our evidence suggests, where people didn't know what the basic study design was all about, or perhaps some of the finer details. Supervision and site visits. I emphasize the site visit because, again, people can think, well, back at home they didn't know what was going on. But the evidence shows and the correspondence shows. People went down, they did see what was going on. The PHS team, excuse me, this is a picture of Dr. Cutler. Dr. Cutler was 31 years old when he went to Guatemala. And he had several of his colleagues from the Public Health Service with him. And there were also, as I show you on the screen, many individuals from the institutions in Guatemala and researchers who collaborated on this work. Juan Funes, the second name there, was a fellow at the VDRL in Staten Island in 45. And Dr. Cutler, writing retrospectively now about the decision to do this research, credited Dr. Funes with the idea to go to Guatemala. So I want to talk to you very briefly about one of the subjects. This is Elisa. Elisa was actually exposed to all of the diseases, chancroid, gonorrhea, and syphilis. She's a subject, she was a patient in the mental asylum. And I'm illustrating this because I want to, again, give you a flavor of what went into the commission's project. So here's a list of female insane asylum patients. Here's Elisa. And to the right, you see number 9. This is a reference to experiment number 9. And here we have the notebook page of experiment number 9. So this is November 30, 1947. Each patient was inoculated intracutaneously with syphilis in this case. And then this is her patient note card. December, we show that she begins to develop some symptoms. We show that in April 48, she got some treatment, and in December 49, there was no evidence of syphilis. This is the information with regard to Elisa and gonorrhea exposure. So June 7, 48, inoculation, and there's Elisa's name down in the lower left. This is the results showing Elisa and, I believe, gram-negative diplococci, suggesting that she, in fact, was infected. This is what's noteworthy about this, besides the fact that it shows Elisa was exposed to chancroid, is when we think about research integrity issues that all of you have dealt with. She's listed here in something titled Studies with the Military, but this is Elisa and the chancroid work, and I show you this again to illustrate the level of detail and the level of diligence that went into trying to get to this, which is an example of our great big database. This is Elisa's, a page with reference to Elisa. Let me emphasize, this is available online. I encourage each and every one of you to look at the work, look at the underlying documents, et cetera. What the commission staff did was take all those kinds of papers, everything that could be said about any individual. We deduplicated names, and the methods are explained at length in the report, to come up with this. One table. Dr. Shomazi makes the point that one table is often worth 1,000 hours. So this table represents the commission's considered judgment about the individuals involved in research, which populations exposed to which diseases, and received any kind of treatment. There's two things I want to emphasize here. The commission did not make a judgment, given the vast array of records, the difficulty the researchers themselves had in diagnosing syphilis, the Spanish, English, just the challenges associated with these documents. The commission didn't make a judgment about who did in fact get infected, nor did they make a judgment about who did in fact receive adequate treatment. What these numbers represent are counts of individuals exposed once or many times to the diseases listed, and individuals treated once or many times with treatment of any form for those diseases. So to jump to, and I really want folks to understand that, because numbers have a way of taking on their own lives. And so, again, this commission did not tell you, and I welcome and encourage scholars to continue to pursue whether people were in fact infected or in fact adequately treated. But what the numbers show was approximately 1,300 people were involved in intentional exposure experiments, were exposed intentionally without their consent to STDs. And of those, 678 received any kind of treatment for those exposures. The age ranges, it is worth noting that generally speaking, children were not involved in the intentional exposure, but in point of fact, as you can see from the chart, sometimes as young as 10, commercial sex workers younger than 18, et cetera. So there are examples here where children were involved. So the commission, and again, my co-presenters will discuss with you in more detail, at the end of the day, the commission concluded that not only were wrongs done, but many individuals in the chain of command were morally culpable for those activities. That's not a legal conclusion. I'm a lawyer by training, and I want to emphasize they did not make a legal conclusion about responsibility, but they did make an ethical one. And in part, their analysis is based on the actions of these same researchers in an intentional exposure experiment involving gonorrhea in Indiana 2 years before this research, when they did get consent from people and they just treated them differently. So the commission released its report in September of last year, delivered it to the president, briefed assorted people, and the public reaction to the report was very positive, I think that's fair to say. And since here's some example of some of those reactions, and since then the commission finished its contemporary report, that's called Moral Science, and gave the obvious point, but I think they validated, that the system today is not what the system was in 46 to 48. And so the commission's view is that these exact set of circumstances, this exact set of wrongs, couldn't be repeated under today's system, but, and I think my colleagues will address, it is worth noting that the elements, intentional exposure experiments, research without consent, deception, elements at times under controlled circumstances are permitted under our current rules, and people can debate, but I would assert with good reason. And so in part, the importance of this story is, in my view, not only to understand what happened and think about how hubris, some of the elements of what went into this, may have application to our lives today, but substantively, thinking about the elements of what was wrong or went wrong and how we might prevent it in the future. So with that, Dr. Zemlin.
Thanks, Valerie. Again, I'd like to correct that. I'm sorry for Dr. Gutman for displacing her. I also want to acknowledge, Valerie mentioned that I was a consultant on this. I also want to acknowledge John Douglas and his colleagues at CDC for actually recommending me for this work, because this has undoubtedly been one of the most interesting things I've ever been involved in. I'm going to discuss what actually happened. What was known, what were the questions, and what was the experimental path towards these studies. By the end of World War II, the efficacy of syphilis and penicillin for syphilis and gonorrhea was being elucidated, and by 1946-47, there were already studies that were done, had been published by John Mahoney, which demonstrated that syphilis was effective for the treatment of, penicillin was effective for the treatment of syphilis. In fact, this had major impact, and I think one of the points that is continued throughout these studies, it had major impact on public health, but was of a special importance to the military, because the military, because of the incidence of sexually transmitted infections in the military, profoundly affected deployability, which was a major issue certainly during World War II. Following the treatment studies, and these were contemporaneous and ongoing, there also was developing of tremendous interest in the preventive treatment of contacts. Now, those of us who work in STDs take this as a statement of fact that somebody who is exposed should get treated to prevent infection. That piece of information was not known during this period of time. And in fact, the premier textbook of the day, Stokes on Syphilis, which was published in 1944, in its third edition, had nothing on prevention. This is a book that was this thick, but really had nothing on prevention, had nothing on preventive treatment, had a lot on the clinical presentation and management. This was where this is the United States Public Health Service Hospital in Staten Island, which I believe the building is still standing. This is where the first clinical trials of penicillin for syphilis were conducted in Mariners. And it's also the home of the Venereal Disease Research Laboratory, the VDRL, which funded the studies. I have a personal connection to this place because when I was inducted into the Public Health Service in 1985 to become an EIS officer, this is where I had my physical exam. I hopefully did not become infected with anything. As Valerie mentioned, there were 12,000 pages of original documents, and she elegantly showed you the amount of work that went into collecting the data that was present and trying to figure out what exactly went on. As I mentioned, the role of penicillin in syphilis was actively known in the medical literature for treatment purposes. These are two articles from the New England Journal of Medicine in 1947. Penicillin and treatment gonorrhea in women is Kim here from Boston. Results of treatment reported by 12 cooperating VD clinics in Massachusetts during 1945. And just to give a sense in terms of a lot of the folks' issues on resistant gonorrhea, the amount of penicillin that was required to treat gonorrhea in 1945 was 50,000 units. That's kind of a whiff compared to what we have to deal with now. In terms of syphilis, actually the treatment has not changed very much once the dosage was actually established. And this is a quote from the New England Journal article by Crawford: "The greatest emphasis in the treatment of syphilis will continue to lie in the use of penicillin." This is 1947. Experimental studies with the various penicillins regarding methods of administration, effects on specific organisms, the possible development of resistance, and so forth continue. As yet, the use of the highly soluble forms of penicillin with frequent injections over periods of some days is the only acceptable method of administration. So just for context, people received either daily or multiple doses per day of penicillin in IM injections. This is before the depot forms such as benzathine were developed. So there were rapid treatment centers which were established by the Public Health Service where this could actually occur. So people may get four to six shots a day, but it was a treatment which was effective and was finished in a week or two compared to the older treatments which required a year or more. So the questions which Cutler asked, and Mahoney and the other individuals who you saw on Valerie's slide asked, can a preventive treatment be evaluated in a model where humans are infected under controlled conditions? Now remember, syphilis and gonorrhea don't have animal models. So there are no animal models, even to this day, which are effective systems where you can evaluate diagnosis and treatment. The comparison groups for the preventive treatment were Orvis Mefarsin, which is the old arsenical preparation, which was still in wide use during this time, compared to penicillin at various doses and various ways of administration, and controls who received nothing. Studies, as you heard, were done in syphilis, gonorrhea, and chancroid. I'll discuss syphilis for the sake of discussion because of a limitation of time. The sources of infected material, since you can't grow syphilis in culture, where did it come from? Well, it came from two sources. One is rabbits. Syphilis is grown in rabbits, and basically what happens is the rabbits are infected and their testicles become infected. The testicles are removed and ground up, and basically a rabbit homogenate is injected. Or the other material is transfer of human material from lesion to lesion. So using contemporary standards of infectious agent transmission, this may give you some pause, but we're not going to discuss what was the standard at the time because it's beyond our scope here. And as you heard, the grant was approved by the Syphilis Study Section in 1946. So the initial approach was, let's develop the model. The model was, as you heard, the first approach was to use commercial sex workers and quote-unquote natural infection. The commercial sex workers were recruited. They were experimentally infected with T. pallidum by direct inoculation onto the cervix. They had intercourse with prison inmates or soldiers under observed conditions. And they were evaluated immediately postcoitally and serially. And the finding was actually the infection rate was low. And therefore, this was around 10%. And therefore, this was not useful for developing prevention studies. The direct infection models then went to a variety of populations that we would contemporaneously call vulnerable populations, which included asylum inmates, psychiatric asylum inmates, prisoners, and Guatemalan soldiers, as well as a small assortment of U.S. military personnel. The infection experiments included either how do you infect somebody? Well, there was swab transfer where a swab of infected material was allowed to lay under the prepuce of an uncircumcised man for a certain period of time or in the cervical os. Pledgets, which are just a more absorbent material. Direct inoculation and scarification. Direct inoculation with scarification. So there's a logical sequence here. There are multiple experiments which looked at differences in dose, in differences in organism pedigree. For example, there are known syphilis strains going back to the early 1900s and looking at the infectivity of different strains. Swab placement time and what I loosely call adjuvants, which was either whether this was human material or rabbit testicular homogenate. This would not be the equivalent of adjuvants that we know today. And then the subjects were followed by serial clinical exams, multiple serological tests, including RPR is a misnomer because RPR did not exist at that time, but there are probably a half a dozen different syphilis serological tests which are being used. All of them were evaluated, and including a large number of subjects who had LPs, lumbar punctures done serially, often via the cisternal method. Now, for those of you who are not medical practitioners, a typical spinal tap is done at the lumbar area. A cisternal tap is done at the base of the cerebellum, so it's right over here, which is not done in contemporary practice, but was much more widely performed at that time, although, as one could imagine, the risks are somewhat greater. The preventive trials, which then followed after establishment of the models, were preventive trials with application of Orvis Mefarsin, penicillin, or IM penicillin after injection. There were time variables that were measured, and as Val showed you, there were large numbers of subjects who were involved, including how long to wait for treatment after exposure. There was longitudinal follow-up and extensive photo documentation. The additional trials which were performed, which did not look at prevention as much as treatment or natural history, included IV infusion of either rabbit material or lesion homogenates into via IV administration to basically induce secondary syphilis. In 7 patients, intracisternal injection of infected material was performed to basically induce acute meningovascular syphilis, including one subject had a very prolonged course which included paralysis for a number of months until she finally resolved, and careful observations on the course and treatment. As you saw, the commission approach in reviewing the documents was to review all the documents to perform a full census of the archive, to define the experiments and consolidate the workbooks, which actually were, as you saw, in multiple different places. This was not exactly an organized workbook scheme. Attempted to define a diagnostic and treatment history for individual subjects and to prepare a spreadsheet of the collected data, which, as Valerie mentioned, is available online as of 2 weeks ago. And this is the timeline. February 1946, the study section approved the project. Cutler arrived in Guatemala in August 1946. The treatment programs begin in August at the Army Penitentiary. The serology studies begin in November. And in December of 1946, there's correspondence which suggests that Surgeon General Perrin, yes, this is the same Perrin after whom we name our award, has become keenly interested in the Guatemala project. This is just a review of part of the table. This is the same table which you'll see probably multiple times, demonstrating that there were 1,384 subjects, 1,000 soldiers, 14 commercial sex workers, 976 prisoners, 716 psychiatric patients involved in the studies. This is just to give you a sense of, where's there a pointer? Of the treatment protocols. What you have on the card to the right, and this is not Elisa but a different subject, is across the left-hand column is the dates of the observations, and across the top are the different serological tests that were performed. So, for example, if you wanted to do an evaluation of the syphilis serological tests that were available at the time, this is one area where you can get it, although certainly if you look, it says BDRL2, the fourth column from the right, it just says positive. It's not titered out. So there are some qualitative differences. Con units, which is the third and fourth columns from the left, were widely used, and these are linked to the clinical data which was recorded on the cards. If you look up at the top on November 30th, 1947, this is injected active in the right forearm. So this is somebody who was injected with the active Nichols strain. Nichols strain is one of the prominent treponema pallidum strains that are used, and this is looking at serological response. This is just another example demonstrating this person, there is qualitative and quantitative data on the Spanish card as well as the English card, which is to the right, and demonstrating this person was free, libre and free of disease after approximately 6 months. The abrasion experiments were done in 1947, and here you see the series of events which occurred in 1947, starting in April. The inoculation experiments were done in April and May in terms of an initiation in the hospital and penitentiary. The syphilis abrasion experiments were performed in August. And in fact, they were starting to get feedback at the end from Dr. Mahoney, who was the director of the VDRL at the time, that he felt that the abrasion methods were drastic. There's also concern, if you note, in June in 1947, there's correspondence which clearly indicates that Dr. Cutler was concerned that the wrong person finding out about the experiments might wreck it or parts of it, and proposes to start sending only the barest summaries of our progress to the Pan American Sanitary Bureau. Here is another, this is actually an example of the gonococcal experiments. If you notice, there's sexual exposure, method of infection, sexual exposure. The number of patients who were in the study was 93, 5 were infected. If you look at superficial inoculation without exposure, the infection rates were much higher, and deep inoculation similarly. So controls, this is also looking at various treatments, so demonstrating how this occurred. This is how gonorrhea was transmitted. With a number 24 needle, a drop of pus was placed on the swab and carefully applied to the navicular fossa of the penis with great care to now not enter deeply into the urethra. This is methods the same used for all inoculation. So this is from a donor. So this is somebody who had gonorrhea. So this is not cultured material. This is pus taken from another donor and then directly transmitted. So I think, in summary, the original design was to test the Orvis Mepharsin prophylaxis, looking at a variety of individuals. I think I've demonstrated to you the experimental path was to look at developing a human model, then develop an experimental trajectory, which included human infections followed by application of prophylactic measures. And I think that's me. Paul?
Well, that's a lot of information to absorb. What I'm going to try to do is to sketch out something about the context in which these studies occurred. And I have to say that since this story broke, one of the most persistent questions that have come up is how could this have happened? Who were the people? What were they thinking? And how could they possibly have been involved in such a sordid episode? And I think that's a reasonable question, and as a historian, my job is to, rather than tell you what was in people's minds, because I wish I were, but I'm not a mind reader, especially not events that happened 60 years ago, what I'm trying to do is to sketch the context in which the whole episode played out. And that is the kind of input that we tried also to give to the commissioners. Here's Dr. Cutler, you've already seen. This is the shot of him as a young officer. And a great deal of the attention in this story has focused on trying to answer these questions. Dr. Cutler, what was his role? Who was he? What kind of person was he? If you looked at the press, if you looked on the web, you would still find that there have been many efforts to vilify Dr. Cutler. He has become, for some people, really the face of evil in this tragic story. I think that is an explanation which is seductive, but a bit too simplistic. Given the horrific methods that he used and some of the populations that endured his work, it's understandable, but it ignores many of the other people who were key to the Guatemala study and how they played out. And it also ignores contemporaneous factors surrounding the studies that may not be immediately obvious. And so I want to discuss what several of those are. But just at the outset, let me make one point abundantly clear. What I'm trying to do here is show you what was in the air, what was going on at the time. This is not an attempt to excuse either Dr. Cutler or, for that matter, anyone else who was associated with these events. What I have to say is not a justification. It's not a rationalization. It's not anything other than an explanation of some of the things that happened in Guatemala. To look at those things in context, and you've already heard and will hear a lot more about the ethical basis upon which both the President and the Commission reached their conclusions, which condemned these events as ethical aberrations. And I would emphasize that I emphatically agree with those conclusions. But my goal is really to try to flesh out a bit more how it was even possible for this work to begin. And I have really three points to focus on. The first one is the obvious medical need and scientific need to understand in detail at the time this study was being planned, Remember, that's a different time than the time it actually began. But at the time it was being planned, to understand how penicillin worked, how other therapeutic agents worked, and how they could be used most effectively. I'll take a few minutes to deal with that. The second point is that the emerging culture of science took a turn, took a formal turn at the time that the study began. The establishment of the NIH grant system, again, you've heard a bit about that, and the accompanying study section structure made the federal funding of science a matter which was controlled in large measure almost exclusively by scientists without a whole lot of external oversight at the time. That's a critical issue. Finally, what I'm going to look at is how, I think most importantly, immediately in the wake of the Second World War, and really with one eye on the next conflict on the horizon, there was a felt need to develop a new regimen of prophylaxis for the armed forces, one that might also be applied in the civil world and the civilian world as well. So with that in mind, let me take these one at a time. Here is the report by Drs. Arnold and Mahoney and Harris, the first pilot study on penicillin and treatment of early syphilis. This is 1943 at the VDRL in Staten Island, the first demonstration that penicillin would cure both syphilis and gonorrhea. This development, of course, truly changed the world of VD research and treatment. It made further clinical studies of penicillin necessary, both to determine its effectiveness against what was then called VD at different doses, and also to settle how useful it would be as a prophylactic agent before seroconversion and as a therapeutic measure after infection had actually taken place. This study, or this conclusion of Drs. Arnold and Mahoney, led directly to other studies, such as the intentional infection study at the Terre Haute prison in Indiana, which was a precedent event to the Guatemala studies. It turned out that the infection, the inoculation study at Terre Haute about gonorrhea, was a failure. It was stopped only a few months after it began, when it became clear that the transmission was very difficult through injection, and that in fact it was not, quote, natural, and that natural methods of transmission would be a better setting for the study. And notice this is a study that's published. The publication comes out in 1946. The study itself was designed in 1942, carried out in 1944, and involving people like Dr. Mahoney, Dr. Van Slyke, and Dr. Cutler, names which continue to pop up in this story. I emphasize the dates because we have to remember that a lot of things were happening, and they were happening very quickly. Not only was there a war on between 42 and 44, between 39 and 44, but also there were other people studying in this area and publishing, and you've seen some of the papers that were published during that period demonstrating different degrees of efficacy for penicillin in different doses, in different batch models, et cetera. So there's a great deal of flux going on in terms of scientific knowledge here. And the timeline of approving of a study and carrying it out in many times might not take into account what was in the pipeline for publication at the same time. So by the time 1946, the Terre Haute study is over, the war is over, there's still no clear understanding of the right dose of penicillin to use for treatment, nor the duration of its effectiveness against syphilis. There are suggestions through other publications, but there's a whole lot of ignorance still at work. At that point, Juan Funes, the young doctor from Guatemala who had studied at the VDRL on Staten Island with Mahoney and Arnold only the year before, becomes a key to the study. He is the man who back home, back in Guatemala, runs the public health clinic where the sex workers are examined and treated regularly. And the laws for, we have the Spanish laws for prostitution in Guatemala at the time. It was legal and it was regulated, and Dr. Funes was in the middle of examining people as they were infected and treating them. He also had connections to the local prison, which we believed when we visited Guatemala we had found adjacent to the treatment facility that Dr. Funes worked in. And so this was a convenient place where regular visits by the sex workers could be allowed, and then they could be watched and then and treated and diagnosed. So Dr. Funes invited Public Health Service doctors down to continue the work of trying to understand the mechanism of penicillin on the several STDs he had witnessed at the VDRL, and they, of course, were more than happy to come because they knew they could never do a study using prostitutes and studying so-called natural transmission of syphilis back in the U.S. So that's the first point, the need to find out more about the therapeutic agents that were available, particularly penicillin, and how they worked in a so-called natural setting. That's one of the drivers. A second driver here, a second point, is what I call generally the culture of science. This is an article by Cassius Van Slyke, one of the officials who was intimately involved in oversight for the Guatemala studies. This article was published in 1946 as well, in late in the year, just as the work in Guatemala was getting underway. And Dr. Van Slyke said that in it, the U.S. Public Health Service Research Grants Program represents a sincere and continuing effort to supply federal funds for the support of necessary additional research in the fields of medical and related science without interposing any degree of government restriction, control, supervision, or regimentation. The program is a scientific one, scientific guidance of which lies wholly in the hands of scientists. Dr. Sykes' ideal, which he elucidates here, is a regimen in which science is guided not by bureaucrats, not by accountants, not by lawyers, but by scientists who are free from the bothersome interference of outsiders. And this is one of the founding motives behind the NIH study section process, which launched, as you've already heard, the Guatemala studies as one of their initial efforts. This is the organizational chart for the study section that regularly evaluated and monitored government research. You've already seen some of these people. This section included some of the most prominent STD researchers in the country, not only Dr. Joseph Earl Moore of Johns Hopkins, a legendary figure in syphilology, but also his colleagues Harry Eagle and John Turner, author of the famous text from the University of Pennsylvania, John Stokes, also John Mahoney, and the head of the VD division, John Heller, who later went on to the National Cancer Institute and Sloan Kettering. So this is the best and the brightest in the field. This group functions in a context where the primary goal, and some would argue the preeminent ethical imperative, was scientific progress, which is not to say that there were no other issues, nor that these people were morally impaired. Rather, that the goal here was to find a cure for some very terrible diseases which had been around for a long time. Dr. Van Slyke's model didn't include external oversight, and in fact, it was possible at that time to keep information about these studies quite close to the vest. Now, it was 20 years later, in a famous article by Henry K. Beecher, about scientific research, that questions were raised over whether or not unethical science was occurring. But even then, in 1966, Dr. Beecher writes about how difficult it is to get true consent from research participants and goes on to conclude that there is a more reliable safeguard, he says, provided by the presence of intelligent, informed, conscientious, compassionate, responsible investigators. So Beecher focused 20 years after the Guatemala studies, 20 years after Van Slyke's article, on training and individual integrity of the researcher and not on any elaborate regulatory structure. He didn't think those things were going to make it better for patients and subjects involved in research. And it wasn't until 6 years after Beecher that the story of the Tuskegee syphilis studies broke, really giving rise to an extraordinary wave of critique and commentary, governmental investigations, and then ultimately federal law, which established the machinery of regulation that currently exists for research done in institutions that receive federal funding. So this is the point I'm making there, is that the structure of scientific inquiry, the actual infrastructure at the NIH, did not include the kind of considerations for outside review and ethical oversight that are now mandatory. And you will see, I think, that where we stand today is at a tension point between the notion of the integrity of the researcher and the machinery, sometimes burdensome machinery, of outside oversight by IRBs, federal regulators, and others. So that's the second issue. The third has to do with war. On the eve of America's entry into World War I, this is about 1917, The high rate of VD diagnosed among men drafted into the service really stunned both medical and civilian authorities. The troops were getting ready to embark to go to Europe, and it was clear then that VD would be a crucial factor in the defeat and lessening power of the armies. This is a quote from an official at the time. In response to this threat, General John Pershing issued an order to the American Expeditionary Forces requiring education in sexual hygiene for all members of the military, establishing medical prophylactic camps stations within camps, and directing each soldier to report for treatment within 3 hours after every exposure for preventive measures. Soldiers who contracted a venereal disease after failing to appear were subject to court-martial for negligently making themselves unfit for service. And during the period between the two world wars, this protocol for VD prophylaxis in the military became routine. It included recommendations that men use condoms to avoid infection, but it also prescribed treatment with ointments, including arsphenamine and mercury, immediately following sexual exposure. Even then, it was recognized that such treatments were of uncertain value in curing the infections, although they seemed to make infectivity lessen and the length of time that men could pass on infections seemed to drop. This regimen remained in place for approximately 20 years. So by the time the Second World War starts, the fear of STDs was not only a military concern, but had remained a civilian concern as well, and is highlighted in the civilian world. Still, there is no effective treatment or prophylaxis for these STDs. No one did as much to make this point, to emphasize and publicize the dangers of STDs, particularly syphilis, between the two wars, as did Thomas Perrin. By the time the Guatemala studies began, he had already made his own reputation, not only in the health arena, but as a public figure as well. You can see him here on the cover of Time magazine. Everyone had heard the story of the CBS radio program that never occurred when the network attempted to censor Perrin's comments, forbidding him to say the word syphilis on the air. He walked out. He left dead air time and soft music playing where his speech was supposed to be. He subsequently publicized the event himself and voluntarily stepped into the spotlight as the champion of education against the forces of ignorance who wanted syphilis to remain the disease that dare not speak its name. Dr. Perrin also had a role in publicizing the dangers of syphilis to the military. He was in the forefront of the effort to educate the American people about the cost of VD to the military effort, and in 1944 was interviewed in this film about VD and war. In it, he said, "The lifeblood of a democracy is your ability to understand and act upon a problem once the facts are presented to you. The purpose of this motion picture is to give you the facts." The rest of this little 20-minute film, which you can watch on YouTube, is a melodrama about an ace flyer who is grounded because he has VD and the cost of his behavior to the combat team. At the end of the film, Dr. Perrin appears a second time and says, "Here we have told only a part of the story of VD control. Untold is the fine work of our churches, our schools, and our social agencies, and what they are doing to prevent the promiscuity which spreads infection." Well, that was 1944. By February of 1947, the same month that researchers began sexual intercourse experiments with the Guatemalan army, a colleague of Dr. Cutler writes him a letter and tells him of Dr. Perrin's interest in his work. And he says, "Dr. Perrin, as you know, is very much interested in the project. And a merry twinkle came into his eye when he said, 'You know, we couldn't do such an experiment in this country.'" It's a open question what one does with that statement, how it's interpreted, and what we should infer from it. But clearly, this is a case where the exigencies of war came into play, and concerns about what could be done normally in America gave way to things that could be done in another place in a situation that was anything but normal. Focusing on Dr. Perrin forces us to consider how much our ethical analysis should incorporate an understanding of the pressures that the agency and the researchers faced to solve the military and social problems that STD posed. If you look at that film again, you'll see lines like this. An officer stands up and says, "Every time there's a war, VD takes a jump. It's bad enough in peacetime, but now it's like a forest fire. No organization of saboteurs could do half this damage to the Army. We average 30 VD cases each year out of every 1,000 men in uniform. That means 300,000 men out of action each year in a 10-million man army, every one of those men a casualty as far as combat is concerned. Think of that, 300,000 casualties without even a battle. So it should come as no surprise to us that the propaganda of the time, VD, is equated with the enemy at war. Here you have a cartoon and a poster, and one, VD is the enemy agent who's throwing literally a monkey wrench into the machinery of combat, and the second one, you can't beat the Axis if you get VD, or even more pointedly, Hitler and Hirohito are the duet to defeat, joined by a third enemy, VD, who was personified first as Ms. G.I. Pickup, and then finally as Death dressed in an evening gown. And finally, back to the clinical point, no prophylaxis is pro-Axis. VD helps the enemy. So there's no question that these messages capture the sense of urgency that everyone who joined the battle against VD felt, equating the need to stamp out the disease with the need to win the war. Even though we do not endorse the ethical fallacy of justifying the dehumanizing experiments in Guatemala by arguing that they were made in the service of war, we still should try to understand how much power that argument may have had at the time. All of which is to say, in closing, as I hope I made clear earlier, that the context in which these experiments took place do not justify how they were carried out. The ethical failures they present are pointed out explicitly in the reports the Commission issued on the Guatemala experience, as well as the second report, Moral Science, which provides a detailed explication of specific expectation researchers and the public should have about how ethical research is conducted. I'm going to stop there and turn it over to Dr. Solmezzi, who will address the ethical problems that the Commission identified in more detail. Thank you.
Thanks to my colleagues for setting up the history, and I'm going to now talk to you about the ethics in more detail. I don't think there's anybody here who would doubt that what was done was wrong, so the task for ethical analysis is to explain why. And here's a rough outline of what I think the reasons are that we should all agree that these experiments were wrong. The first, in terms of the failure to obtain informed consent from these individuals who are involved in both the exposure and the serologic studies, is a violation of autonomy of individuals. Secondly, there are questions about the design of the work. You saw some of the study cards and the way in which it was set up, that if the purpose of research is to be of public beneficence, it turns out that some of these experiments were not very good at giving us conclusive, usable evidence, so that they weren't as beneficent as we might think. Third, that individuals were harmed in this, and that would violate a principle of non-maleficence, which goes back to Hippocratic times. Fourth, that similars were treated dissimilarly. This is since the time of Aristotle, foundation of what it means to act justly, to treat similars in a similar way. But in fact, we have evidence here that people who were otherwise similar were treated dissimilarly. And then lastly, that I think there was a failure to respect subjects as persons. And this would violate a principle of human dignity. This is sort of my take on what's wrong with it from an ethical perspective. It's compatible with the Commission's report, but a slightly different way of formulating it. So if we would agree that what was done was wrong, the big question that we maybe want to face all together today is, can we hold individuals responsible? As you just heard from Paul Lombardo, there was a context in which this was occurring that makes it difficult to try to demonize people or come to immediate blame for them without some serious consideration from an ethical perspective of whether that's possible or not. So the first kind of argument that might be given that this sort of behavior was justifiable would be one of cultural and historical relativity. Well, we might say, well, you know, those were the times. We didn't really have the kinds of standards we have now. You still have the atmosphere of the fight against syphilis, the war effort, etc. That was the culture of science, was the culture of the country. And so these are such mitigating factors that we can't really hold these persons culpable. But if you take a really serious view that there are no statements that can be made about ethics that are true outside of a specific cultural and historical context, you've got some problems. One of those is how then would we have been saying at the Nuremberg trials that the Nazis were wrong. They had a culture and a war effort in which their experiments were being conducted as well, and we have no way of judging, if we have this deep a sense of cultural and historical relativity, that there are such things as crimes against humanity or war crimes. Secondly, if you note something about that kind of a statement, that there are no possible true, universally true statements that can be made about ethics outside of a particular historical and cultural context, if you think for about 30 seconds, you'll realize that it's performatively self-refuting, right? If it's true, it's actually false, right? Because of this, this sort of deep sense of ethical relativity really isn't philosophically sustainable. What may be more reasonable to suggest is that we may have a theory of moral progress, that the actions that were performed by these persons or other persons in other contexts could be judged to be objectively wrong, but that we have a theory that human society grows in its awareness of moral truth over time, and so that the individuals in a particular time wouldn't be held completely culpable for that. So you might say that, well, slavery has always been wrong, but we just didn't really finally come universally to understand that till much later, so that a Roman slave owner in the second century of the Common Era might not be culpable for owning slaves, because that's what was there at the time. Even though slave ownership is wrong, they just hadn't come to that judgment collectively at that time. So that's something that we might want to think about in terms of whether or not that applies to these kinds of cases in Guatemala, and think about whether that exculpates those who were involved. So let's go through each of the kinds of considerations that I gave you more generally and think about them in terms of individual culpability. The first issue, as you heard from some of the previous presenters, is that there was no record of any of the subjects giving informed consent. Some subjects, including those with mental illness in the psychiatric asylum and children in the serologic studies, didn't actually have the capacity to give informed consent. And the evidence shows, and you heard some about this, that the researchers intentionally deceived some subjects about the nature of the study and what was being done to them. So there's some evidence, for instance, that there was language akin to what was used in Tuskegee, that these things were presented as treatments or obfuscations about what was actually being done when the persons were enrolled in these studies, and no records of actual formal informed consent. And you might say, well, there wasn't really a great doctrine of informed consent at that time. But it's interesting, particularly in the history of venereal diseases and infectious diseases and medical ethics, that Albert Neisser, for instance, for whom gonorrhea, Neisseria gonorrhea, is named, in 1898 was doing syphilis studies in which he was injecting serum of syphilitic prostitutes into infected persons. And some of them came down with, or into normal subjects as a prophylaxis, and people got sick from this. And he was actually prosecuted in Prussia, and the Prussian government court said that there should be no experimentation, particularly of this kind of inoculation, without the informed consent of subjects. I'll show you in a moment that William Osler criticized Santarelli for some of his injection experiments in 1898. On the clinical side, the case that is famous in clinical medical ethics of Schlondorf v. the Society of New York Hospital, Justice Cardoza said that every individual of adult years and sound mind must only be operated upon if they are able to give their informed consent, and if somebody doesn't obtain that consent, they are liable for charges. And so that was available. And then, of course, we have the amazing fact to me about all of this experimentation that you'll notice that these experiments were contemporaneous with the Nuremberg trial, for which the Nazi physicians were tried, not only for hypothermia and altitude experiments, but for experimental inoculations of wound infections with Clostridia and Streptococcus. You might ask whether they were reading the newspapers in Guatemala at that time. So here's a quote from Cushing's Life of Osler from 1898. It says, V.C. Vaughan in the discussion had mentioned as ridiculous Santarelli's experimental inoculations on man. Excuse the gender exclusive language of the day. And is reported to have followed these with an emphatic denunciation of these experiments. Even granting, he said, that every dose of medicine we give is an experiment, to deliberately utilize a human being for the purpose of experimentation without the sanction of the individual is not ridiculous, it is criminal. It was 1898. So people had an idea, at least for this kind of inoculation experiment, that informed consent was something that was necessary from an ethical point of view. And we have, finally, evidence that these investigators actually knew that. Because, as you heard, in the Terre Haute experiments they did with gonorrhea, while those were not very successful, they actually obtained informed consent from the prisoners that they worked on. Many of the very same individuals, including Cutler, who then went to Guatemala, and then ignored that standard and frequently sought to deceive patients and, as you heard, to deceive outside observers about what they were actually doing. So if you want to judge individuals by the standards of the day, the best way to do it is by their own behavior. And their own behavior would suggest that they actually had a precedent for obtaining informed consent, which they did not apply when they went to Guatemala. Second, there's a question about whether this is beneficent or not. The main justification for doing any sort of research is public beneficence. We can criticize, perhaps, that these were not scientifically designed very well. You could see the sort of pictures of all the various notebooks and how haphazard some of it was, the way in which some experiments were begun before the pilot was completed. They weren't necessarily that carefully designed. Importantly, a lot of this was kept secret. Not all the subjects were treated, as you could see evidence of that already given, and there was very poor follow-up for the individuals who were inoculated. And if primum non nocere is an issue, which we'll get to, that seems to be a problem. I am a bit worried at some times that we'd be too critical about the methodology because we weren't really yet in the era of randomized controlled trials, and I don't want to judge us anachronistically by that sort of standard. After all, the experiments that showed that penicillin worked were an uncontrolled experiment on four individuals. So this was not necessarily a lot of what was done, I think, was sort of the science of the day. But still, it wasn't very carefully designed. Here are some of the, in the interest of time, I'll go through these quickly. Inconsistent notes that were taken in the reports, changes in the dates, one thing being said to be done on May 10th, the other said it was done on May 13th, whether they're in the asylum, where they are, et cetera, when these things were done, what was used, whether it was human material or rabbit material, seems in some of the notes to be confused for different subjects. Were there violations of non-maleficence? Again, from the time of Hippocrates and the oath that says, I will apply dietetic measures for the benefit of my patients, keeping them from harm, this was something that was available as knowledge of ethics to the investigators at this time. As was said before, I do not believe that inoculation experiments are intrinsically wrong, but I think we would all agree that if we were to conduct such experiments, that we need to provide safeguards for the individuals. Cisterna magnum injections of emulsions of a chancre containing a dark field positive spirochete material seems to me to not be something that is 100% beneficent, particularly when there was no knowledge that penicillin would actually be able to treat that sort of disease at that time. Some subjects, as you saw, were never treated, and often patients would, at least by today's standards, be undertreated when these experiments were done. So here are some of the studies, a case study about Maria, a cisternal puncture, 1 cc of human emulsion on June 3rd. As you heard before, she gradually lost the use of the two legs, of the legs 2 months ago, became completely bedridden. Total treatment was 9.4 million units of penicillin. Eventually did recover. For those of you who don't know what a cisternal puncture is, and you had a little bit of demonstration before, here's a picture of what it actually is. And some of these cisternal punctures were done for the serology studies. Some were done for the inoculation studies, that actual preparations of syphilis were injected into the cisterna magnum of several subjects. This is more on Berta. We'll get through that to the next case. Next question about justice. Again, since the time of Aristotle, and probably for you growing up, the worst thing that could happen is that you could say to your mother that she was treating you differently than your sibling, right? This is what justice is about, that similars should be treated similarly. But I think we have evidence that these were individuals who were not treating similarly situated individuals similarly. The quote attributed to Thomas Paine, "You know, we couldn't do such an experiment in this country." Right? So what we couldn't do to human beings in the United States, we thought we could do to human beings in another country. It would strike me that should be a violation of the dictum that similar should be treated similarly. Elsewhere, with respect to something like informed consent, some of the reason being given for not obtaining informed consent from this subject's quote, "Indians are only confused by explanations and by knowing what is happening," unquote. Finally, violations of human dignity. One of the striking things to me in looking over some of the notes is the dispassionate discussions of the need to increase the efficiency of infection. This became sort of the obsession. We can't do the prophylaxis experiments until we can get an efficient route for infecting human beings. And this is what led to the pre-inoculation genital abrasion. And in some descriptions, you had to put a toothpick in, and it had to be penetrated far enough that there would be pain before one actually thought that there was a sufficient abrasion to be able to increase the efficiency of uptake of the experimental infection in these persons. And prostitutes were purposefully not treated and used as reservoirs for spirochetes and for gonococci. It seems to me that these are violations of human dignity, which somebody ought to have known about in the 4th century B.C. as well as in the middle of the 20th century in the Common Era. And I guess the question that's always raised and will always be before us in terms of research ethics is whether or not a beneficent social end justifies any and every scientific means. Certainly there was a pressing need, as you heard from Paul Lombardo, about the need to decrease the rates of infection and come up with a way to prophylax against these venereal infections. But if you believe, as I do, that Immanuel Kant is right when he says that at the heart of ethics is something like this, that we should act in such a way that we treat humanity, whether in our own persons or in that of other persons, always at the same time as an end and never simply as a means, you might agree with the commission that many of the individual subjects in these studies were treated as mere means for the investigators and not respected as ends in themselves. And we therefore were able to come to the conclusion that not only are these were these experiments to be judged wrong from our own time point, but that they were wrong at the time the experiments were done and that the investigators who were conducting them had reason to know that they were wrong and can be held culpable. Thank you.